I'd left Leningrad after spending some time in Russia and gone on to Helsinki, Finland being my objective. Why Finland? I was interested in the Finno-Ugrian group of languages and peoples. There was a reason for that. I'd gone to Russia because I'd found in my ancestry that I was a descendant of a Russian king of the 8th and 9th century. And later on, I found also in my ancestry a genealogical material my son had brought back from his mission in Iceland, that I was also the descendant of the daughter of a Hungarian princess. And therefore, I was interested in Hungary and Finland. But I found in doing some preliminary research that the Finno-Ugrian languages and people include the Finnish, Northern Russian, and Hungarians. On the boat, in fact, I had been on this particular boat for some time, and I'd been in Germany, in East Germany. There was a particular young girl, her name was Maya, and she was Finnish. She had gone to the University of Turku in Finland, and I had asked her, if I ever got into Finland, where I might be able to find some books that would give me some information on the Finno-Ugrian groups. In fact, I was looking for what they call the epic, the Kalevala, the folklore and history and cosmology of the ancient Finns. She had indicated that in Helsinki there was a beautiful bookstore, a very good one, and that I should probably visit that bookstore and I might be able to find some help. After I had toured inner and upper Finland, it's a beautiful country. Nearly 30% of the country is lakes. I returned to Helsinki and got off and explored the city itself, looking for this particular bookstore. I found it all right, but I didn't speak Finnish, and for a little while I had a difficulty trying to convey to the clerks who were there what I was looking for. I found three clerks back in the back end of the huge, many-storied building who were talking, and one of them seemed to have an official label on her dress, so I asked in English if any one of them could speak English. She turned to me and said that she could. She also turned out to be an official of the bookstore. I couldn't have asked for a happier circumstance. My time was limited. I wasn't going to spend a half a lifetime in Finland trying to track down what I wanted. I was looking for an answer to a prayer. It came. I told her my needs. I wanted anthropological, archaeological, sociological, and other studies dealing with the Finnish and the Ugrian peoples, and the Kalevala in particularly. We went into various departments that she had, and at first we really didn't find anything, until finally, in one of the areas of poetry and Finnish folklore, we came upon a book called Finnish Folk Poetry and Epic. What it was a Kalevala in an updated form, including material from Estonia, Finland, and Russian Karelia to the north in the Baltic Finnish region. When I told her this is exactly what I was looking for, then the light seemed to dawn upon her, and within a short period of time, we went to the language library department and found an excellent book that had been written by a Hungarian, Peter Hajdu, called The Finno-Ugrian Languages and Peoples. And from there, it wasn't long until she had archaeology books dealing with the ancient cultures of the Uralian peoples of North Russia. And in the university section, there was books on the Laps and the Lappish culture from the University of Turku. I couldn't have got a better survey of books and access to them if I'd gone to the university itself. And then there were special studies by Carl Nickel and others on the Lappish nations and citizens of the four countries, and other publications, oddly enough, that had been published in the United States and ended up over in Finland because they were Finnish authors. They had been translated by Atkinson of the University of Indiana on the Finno-Ugric peoples. Let me embark then upon a short study, an introduction to you of these peoples and why I was interested in them, apart from the fact that my ancestry in part was traced back to them. In Finland, of course, you have a very unique language. The Finno-Ugrian groups of languages, they have 20 different members. The Hungarian and Finnish are the larger of these. The Laps are a small part. Where did they come from? When did they occupy these territories? Were they related to an Ephraim movement, of which Latter-day Saints have a great tradition, of the 7th century before Christ? Were they part of the inheritance of Japheth and Shem of an earlier period of time when Noah embarked in the Armenian area? Or were they some members of the 10 tribes? Now, there's various methods that such things can be examined. The questions can be asked. From a Latter-day Saint standpoint, they're more than just technical questions. They border upon our own cultural and religious history. So here's what we find. There was a man by the name of Ottar Hegeland. He was on a Norwegian ship, a vassal of Alfred the Great. He sailed along the northern coast of Scandinavia and the peninsula towards the end of the 9th century and anchored on the White Sea coast near the present town of Archangel. In his report on the journey, he observed that the language of the Lapps of northern Norway resembled those of the Jermas he found on the White Sea coast. He was recognized that Lapps of northern Norway, Finland and Sweden, and Russia were of somehow related character. The similarity between Hungarian and Vogel and Ostiak was first noted by a monk of Verona. His observations were recorded by Silvius, who later became Pope Pius II. Later references to this relationship were made by Michu, a physician to the Polish court at the beginning of the 16th century. And then, during Herbstein's diplomatic journeys to Russia, he heard news of the Ob-Ugrians from witnesses who had met them during campaigns then launched by the Russians to conquer Siberia. And quite independently, a Swedish scholar and poet, Sternheim, discovered the affinity between Hungarian and Finnish languages. And this was 1671. Stralenberg, a Swedish captain, made a prisoner at the Battle of Poltava, 1709, spent 13 years in exile in Siberia. That's a rough way and a rough time to learn about things, but he was a keen observer, didn't let it get to him. He collected valuable material about the people living there. He lists the first large group of the Boreal, Oriental, or Northeast languages. You have to give a man credit 270 years ago to have been and had the presence of mind to do that. Now, in Hungary, in 1770, Szajanovics' study and Gyermathy's study of 1799 proved the relationship between Lappish and Hungarian. Now, he used a method which made him a precursor or forerunner of modern comparative linguistics. And this is rather exciting. We'll give you some examples as we go along. This will be a different kind of presentation than you're probably used to, but it's useful for anyone doing this kind of research. At any rate, the new reliable material was coming forth on comparative historical lines and comparative linguistics. The work really began in modern terms in 1840. The work was carried on in pioneer fashion by the Hungarians, three of them, and also four Finns. The main lines of development of these languages were established, and the broad outline of the original primeval common language successfully reconstructed. Now, the question, of course, that rises, is this language one of those developed after the Tower of Babel, for example? Is that really a historical event? The Bible says so. The Book of Mormon mentions it. The Jaredites were part of it. So we have to take it seriously. So we can do some examinations, and that's what we're doing. We're examining some of these allusions and implications. Now, while the languages that were involved herewith have retained their Finno-Ugrian characteristics despite all the changes that have occurred in them, these particular investigations and these people are very prime candidates for such a search. The peoples have changed all out of recognition by admixtures and foreign influences in the course of history. The relationships between Finno-Ugrian peoples as well as languages are most interesting. We have historical and linguistic. The former is the realm of the historian, prehistorian, and the latter is the realm of the linguist. The prehistory of a people concerns its earliest degree of development, and we're going to try to explore some of that, and we use every tool available: folklore, linguistics, archaeology, anthropology, ethnology, paleo-osteology, and others. Historic events leave their mark on languages. Loanwords can be divided into different strata. It has always been proved that a great number of them were taken over before the arrival of the Hungarians in present-day Hungary, for example, when you examine the Hungarian language and when you compare the 20 families together. A linguistic analysis of the names of rivers And settlements, for example, on the western slopes of the central Urals, for example, have led to the deduction that that area was once settled by a very early primitive group of the Finno-Ugrians, called the Vogels, who are therefore not to be regarded as the original inhabitants of Siberia, where they are now to be found because they've been driven from this ancient central Ural area to their present Siberian area. So we find from the place names of the rivers which language these names are derived from. We find that a people speaking their language once lived in this central Ural area. Now the Hungarian word for bed is interesting, to give you a linguistic example. It is of Finno-Ugrian origin and can be traced back to a common word. It does not mean a piece of furniture. In fact, it means a layer of hay or some type of underbrush covered with pelts placed along one side of the tent, which serves as a bed. So it indicates that the Finno-Ugrian people were originally nomadic or semi-nomadic, and that their present settled mode of life and in a civilized area has carried in their language something about their origins. Now, Finno-Ugrian and Samoyed are themselves, that's the entire family language, descendant of a common language called Uralic. And we're trying to find the Uralic period. When will it jive with anything we know historically? And to get this strata, we use the linguistics, for example, the names of flora and fauna. These form a common word list and will give a fair knowledge of the plant and animals known to the speakers of the original language and the areas in which they flourished. And if we find where these names are plotted on maps and the home of the speakers then can be determined, then we might find the region in which all are to be found. The Finno-Ugrian people thus knew bees and honey. So did the Jaredites, and lived in an area where the honeybee could be found. Is this a common or a coincidental situation? But the bee is not found in Siberia. It's not found in Turkestan. It's not found in Central Asia. It's not found in Mongolia. On the other hand, the bee is found west of the Urals, again, in Eastern Europe, mainly from the northern limit of the Oak. And there's a special latitude, 57 to 58 degrees southwards, and the Middle Volga River region was known of old as a bee-keeping area. Are we talking then about the possibilities of a similar or parallel movement of peoples about the time of the Jaredites with beekeeping capabilities moving into the Volga and upper Dnieper area, the headwaters of the Don? Well, the Finno-Ugrian peoples were based in the Middle Volga and Kama regions originally. The precise boundaries of this ancestral home cannot be exactly totally determined by linguistic paleontology, but you can get a few ideas. In the Oka Valley, for example, this valley must have been inhabited by the Finno-Ugrian people, evidence archaeologically, as they were there around 2500 B.C. So we're not talking about an Ephraim movement. We're not talking about a Mosaic movement. We're not talking about anything that might be biblically related. We're talking about an earlier shift of people. Two candidate time periods might be involved. One would be the Jaredite movement or parallel to it after the Tower of Babel, or after the Noahic flood when Shem was given his particular inheritance. Because we do find as we proceed further that these original peoples were Indo-European. In fact, they're related to Indo-Iranian peoples, ancient Persians, Akkadian, and Sumerites. We find that some of their decorated earthenware, that earthenware of a certain period archaeologically permits us to find that the individuals who occupied, used, and traded extended eastward from the Baltic and the White Sea to western Siberia. This area then can be ascribed to be at least a possible candidate for these early Finno-Ugrian people. Now, on the tundra, there's nothing to prevent reindeer herds and their guardians from wandering hundreds of kilometers. Indeed, this way of life compels the Nenets, or the Lapish equivalent people, to occupy a vast stretch of land in the northern areas of Russia. But were they there originally? Is that something they did earlier? We'll find that that's something they've done very recently. It is true that the pottery culture that we've talked about extended from Baltic to the Urals. No means, of course, can really identify an ethnocultural zone, but the Volga, Oka Central region, the Ural Kama region, are areas in which we might look for the evidences that might show great migrations and completed ethnic changes. And sure enough, we do find that at the end of the third millennium, around 2000 BC, in the early beginning of that period, the Volga-Oka culture extended northwards, penetrating to the left bank tributaries of the Volga to the White Sea. Apparently, this was a peaceful migration. Why? Warlike transfers of population have occurred, and around 2000 BC, the Finno-Ugrians of the Ural Kama were indeed invaded by other larger bands. Thus, the Finno-Ugrians appear at the beginning of the second millennium along the lower and middle Oka Valley, and even further north of it, as original indigenous people. They penetrated westward not only along the Volga, but also along another northern route, the upper Kama River, toward the north Dvina River. We find the original home of the Finno-Ugrians therefore lay between the Urals, the great mountains that stretched north and south practically, and the Kama River. Now, there are traces of very old and important connections with other languages and language groups. The Finno-Ugrians seem to have been unified with Proto-Indo-Europeans, and then that had broken up. You have some Turkic and Altaic elements as well, showing some relationship to those Semites of the Indo-European, Indo-Iranian areas. These are interesting to pursue. But we still want to learn a little bit about the original habitat and how we might arrive at that. And then we want to examine some of the teachings, because they would not have Mosaic teachings as such. They would have an earlier patriarchal type of doctrine. Would it fit into what we understand from the Prophet Joseph Smith's revelations in this dispensation? Well, we find that the speakers of this ancient language lived in a vast area at a very early era, discernible through the science of prehistory and archaeology and anthropology and so forth. The process of the disintegration of these people was through internal factors into the 20 now known groups. The largest are Finnish and Hungarian today. The Finno-Ugrian peoples still preserve some form, however, of tribal organization. It is patriarchal. So we've confirmed at least that portion of it, and that becomes encouraging. There seems to be an incomprehensible attributing to the inference of higher beings in the life of an individual. There's also a knowledge of the prince, the lord of the underworld. There's also a knowledge of spirit. In fact, these people offered sacrifice mainly to avoid catastrophe and illness and to cure sickness. The ritual includes the shaman or priest. And since it's a patriarchal order, he comes forward as the intermediary between humans and the spirit world. Now, these teachings are not found, or particular things are not found outside of this particular group of people, but they are to be expected in a group that might have had patriarchal knowledge down to the time right after the flood. They worshipped ancestors or revered them, and the dead in general. They had the beginnings of a priestly order. These individuals in the Uralic group, of course, had a society which spoke a unified language and formed a unified and genuine community. The mingling of other European elements can be deduced where the languages have been exposed. We have found that there are now three groups of people represented, mainly due to the pressure from three different directions. You have the first Uralic type of people. They have a mesocephalic head, thin, straight hair of black or dark brown color. The skin is not very dark. And they have varicolored eyes. The epicanthus is not often found, so there's not much Mongoloid influence there, but this is the group in which the Mongoloid influence is felt because of the pressures to the east. And the general stature is short. Then you have what they call the White Sea Baltic, or East European type. This is strongly European. Fairly short head, straight or gentle wavy hair of a blonde coloring, light skin and eyes, fairly dense, hair and face and nose hair, and the nose is straight or snub with moderately high bridge. These are the Baltic Finns, and the Permians, the North Russians, and the Poles. And then there's the third type. This is the Atlantic Black Sea group. These are dark people, somewhat wavy hair, Thick facial hair, dark, very colored eyes, a long face, and high bridge nose, either straight or slightly hooked, with a mesocephalic head structure. These are the Caucasian races, Tartar and Balkan. Then, of course, you have a fourth type called the characteristic Lapinoid. These are of a mixed variant, however. So we can identify certain types, and you can see that we're familiar with the Finno and in the Hungarian areas. These are the White Sea Baltic types. The Ugrians came to keep horses. Now, we have proof of a horse culture, and it can be found in the words they use. And this is where the linguistics become very interesting, because they have words for saddle, for whip, for stirrup, for shoe bottom, horse breeding, the difference between a two-year-old and a three-year-old. And they have a number of words for horses in general. This helps give us a little idea of their horse background. And yet, in the northern Russia area, they don't have horses. They no longer exist in that area. They have been moved forward, away from something they knew familiarly in a younger period. The greatest gods in their poetry, for example, are called Man, the man who watches over the world. And Moses was told that the name of God was Man. He's also identified as a heavenly father, and that he possesses great herds. And so they have him mainly on horseback, according to their songs. We understand a little bit about the earlier history, and that they weren't quite warlike, because they carried arrows in quivers. But the particular area arrow quiver used by equestrian peoples, warlike peoples, they had no name for it. So in the absence of certain things, we have an idea of the ancestral character of the people. The ancestors of the Ugrian people seem to have lived in one linguistic community for about 1,500 years. There was a fraternity, and they used the word moss, and this particular fraternity was headed by what they called Numi Torum. He was the greatest god. He was an ancestor. They were derived from him. They were descendants of a great god. There was also another fraternity or a group, and these individuals were called the Menjki. They had descended from the devil or were his. There was also a bear cult. This is interesting for those who attended the temple, the bear and the tiger and the horse and so forth. There's interesting situations there. The Ugrian and certain foreign names preserve the traces of other origins. We can even identify about the time that the Hungarians assumed their particular name, the Magyars, and when they began to move into their particular area. Now, in the first half of the first millennium B.C., it's about 500 B.C., the Lapps, whose origin is sometimes of a mystery because of the extremes to which they've been driven by pressure, they moved northwards. The Finnic peoples continued to live beside the Baltic Sea. But the Lapps, as they moved forward north, carried with themselves some very ancient traditions. In studying the Lapp religions, we find 32 major parallels to Mormon doctrine of the ancient order familiar to Abraham and the patriarchs who preceded him, including interesting things concerning the Seder stone, a seer stone, the presence of individuals, intermediaries between deity, the adversary, pre-existent spirits, and such things as foot-to-foot, knee-to-knee, and an arm-to-back, and other things, and the new name that can only be found in the particular ceremonies that we find of sacred character in our temple. These have been discussed in a tape by my brother, Lynn Erickson, on the Ephraim inheritance in Scandinavia. But to account for many of the things that the Lapps understood, we either have to explain a later Ephraim movement into this area and being absorbed by these people. But since certain things are missing in that conveyance, then we still believe that much of the Finno-Ugrian peoples retain teachings of a pre-Mosaic time. Their language is quite interesting. We find that the modern Hungarian languages contains 14 short and long vowels, and that it is a musical language, made so by the law of vowel harmony, and a rhythm was added to its melodious flow by regular accentuation of the first syllable. This language is not a confusion of unarticulated sounds, but made expressive by the movements of the face and the body. And the process of separation of the noun from the verb and so forth, the two most important categories of a word, took a considerable amount of time. We can trace that out through these particular people, and they're probably one of the best peoples on earth to do this with. we find that there's also an interesting aspect in the classification of Indo-European languages. The Indo-Europeans are called inflected, but these ancient Uralic languages are agglutinating. This means that there was a separation of languages sometime around the middle of the 3rd century before Christ, which separated almost in opposite ways the language of the southern Indo-Europeans and these northern Indo-European derivatives in this ancient area. They even have beautiful long letters or words with 103 letters in a giant word. And the whole word contains everything from verbal noun, adjective, formatives, derivatives, suffixes, plural incessives, and third person possessive, and emphatic suffixes and interrogatives in just one word. Now, this is probably just of interest. But when we go into the languages itself, we find that there is the absence, again, of certain things. Now, the Navajo Indians had no words, for example, to express such ideas as Jeep, radar, and Air Force. So we knew, you can easily see the significance there. And yet, by virtue of utilizing the Navajos in World War II, they were able to establish a communication system that was most remarkable, and the Japanese could never break it, nor could any of the Europeans. If we look a little bit at the world at large, we can see the uniqueness of this 20 groups of language. There are at least 2,796 languages spoken in the world. Two-thirds of mankind use just 13 of these. There are at least 1,200 American Indian languages. When you talk about certain languages, you find that the Chinese is only spoken by approximately 1 billion people. One-fourth of the human race speaks Chinese, or a dialect or derivative of it. Hindustani and Russian, they include almost 300 million today. Spanish, about 200 million. German, over 100 million. Japanese and Arabic, 90 million. And Malaya, about 100 million. French, about 100 million. Bengali and Portuguese, about 100 million. And Italian, about 75 million. Thus, you see again, two-thirds of mankind, a little more than that, as a matter of fact, use only 13 languages. But the Finno-Ugrian languages, in the light of these figures, is not particularly encouraging. There's only about 20 million speakers, and they share 19 varieties of their own language. The Hungarian, nearly 20 groups, comprise almost 75% of that particular group of people. So the Hungarians are the largest of the Finno-Ugrian people. They occupy their present Pannonian basin only since the 9th century. They had been forced out because of incursions from the east into that particular area. The Hungarian People's Republic today is only about 100,000 square kilometers. They have only about 15 million people. But the frontiers of modern Hungary were only established in 1919. So again, we're bordering on something that's fairly recent. But in the study and analysis of these ancient peoples, we have rather exciting things that help us. Now again, back to the religion. They had a totem animal personifying their ancestors. They knew about evil spirits, and like even the Latter-day Saints, without that consciousness, they ascribed an individual personality to all the things that happened around and in the forces of wind and rain and terror created by thunder and lightning. But they had sacrificial ceremonies. They had an understanding of the healing of sickness, prevention of troubles. They had various cults. Some of these can be seen to have been modified by the artifacts found in their recovered archaeological graves and other places. In their folk songs, we also find another kind of history. The deeds of their ancestors, their wars and adventures, and their features, of course, these are mythical, but they're cosmogenic also, and they have legends concerning the origins and creations and bear songs and dramas and so forth. Even the spells are the way to conjure up the gods and to get some help out of them. We might, for just a few minutes, examine some of these religions. In the culture of the Ugarian peoples, we find a great deal that is of interest to the Latter-day Saint. In antiquity and among the primitive people, the model of the world sometimes is opposed by diametrically opposed symbols. Night and day, for example, oppositions. You have this dualism reflected in Mormonism, certain times in Christianity, in Zoroastrianism, and so forth. And so when you go into a strange group of people, you start asking them such questions. What do they have for words for life and death, fortune, misfortune, above and beneath, sky and earth, north and south? things of this kind, do they have any concepts? In fact, a geologist has an interesting thing in going into any primitive country. You can take examples of gold in nugget form or examples of gold in rock. You can show it to the individuals of these primitive peoples. If they have a name for what you show them, then they are aware of gold in their territory. So you can use these kind of things for even exploration. You can show them pitch and bitumen. If they have seen any such thing, they'll have a name for it. If they have no name for it, for any of those things, then most likely, since they've been inhabitants of that territory for a long time and crawled over most inches of it with their hands and knees, those things may be absent or missing. But at least it's an interesting criteria. I think you can get the gist of it. Now, the Uralic worldview, the creation of the earth is connected from Eastern Europe to the Altai Mountains with the motive of bringing up sand from water. Why, we're back into the fourth chapter of Abraham. During the work of creation, the supreme deity and the devil, the latter being the brother of the former. Now, whoever indicated that the creator and the devil were brothers? This is Mormon doctrine. Lucifer and Jehovah are brothers. We have relevant tales concerning this and the devil. He's characterized by negative features in the system of opposition. The doctrine of opposites in all things we find in the Book of Mormon enunciated by Lehi, but you have evil, darkness, harmfulness, is further distinguished from the Creator by his ability to transform himself. The ancient legends also include the story of bringing the earth out of the water, in addition to the world egg, generally known as the Kalevala. This is what I was searching for when I went into Helsinki originally, and now I have my full copy of it and up-to-date through the epic of the Finnish people. It is interesting to note that some researchers try to connect the image of the earth emerging from the water and growing ever larger and measured by the time of the flight of a returning bird. Is this a Noahic reference? With a closing motive of the flood, these people had a most interesting parallel. They had a particular image of the earth re-emerging a second time from water, and that this was measured by the time of the flight of a returning bird. Where could they have got any such contact when they had no such thing with any biblical reference in the early time period we're talking about? Furthermore, the conception of a creative genius floating above the waters, spirit of the gods in the fourth chapter of Abraham, brooding upon the waters, represented by a bird. Is this perhaps the Holy Ghost symbol of the dove? I'm asking the question. I won't provide an answer at this time. At any rate, this is an old motif that can be traced into the accounts of great antiquity. Now, you have other images, not quite like that, in such peoples as the Japanese, the Russian, Crimean Tartar, and Jewish biblical tradition. How come? What's the connection? Now, the world tree, for they have the tree of life symbol. They have a sun and a moon, and a basic element not only of Ugrian culture, but also the Finno-Ugrian period, and going back to an older period. You have the German and Scandinavian traditions, but they know nothing of such images that we're talking about. There's also a living tree, under the branches of which the pond of the water of life is situated. Here we have Book of Mormon overtones, and the prophecies of Zenos and Zenoch. And the individual branches of this tree represent the different levels of heaven. And the moon is found in the sixth and the sun in the seventh celestial level. Why would the moon and the sun represent different kingdoms or glories, and the earth represent a celestial level and that there's a seventh heaven? Numitorem is the supreme god of the Vogels. He lives in a seven-tiered house in the seventh-storied heaven. The idea of heaven with several layers is typically mingled with that of heaven as identified with a mountain, a world mountain. There's a peculiar conception here, the structure of the world, that confronts us when studying the phenomenon of the world tree. We find also they have a tripartite structure of the world. The nether world is situated beneath the earth, not under the earth or in the middle of it, but beneath it. Then the middle layer is the earth itself, and it belongs to living creatures. Then you have the upper world, or heaven. They have this tripartite structure. In the heavens, this area is inhabited by the gods. And they have thus a division of the universe. When you reconstruct their situation, it comes close to some of the 76th section of Doctrine and Covenants, because it talks about the upper world of the gods and that of the world of the living bodies and dead bodies on one hand, and the living bodies and mortal ones on another hand. And the idea of the world tree played a central role in the world conception of both the Siberian and the Central and Inner Asiatic peoples. Of the celestial bodies, it is the sun and the moon that occur frequently in the narratives of these ancient people. And a highly important theme is connected with the personification of celestial bodies in ancient times. They had seven different words for the sun. The seven suns, for example, of a supreme deity, have the function of controlling destiny and conveying the will of their father. That the supreme deity had seven suns acting as angelic powers, conveying his will and controlling the destiny of the world. Is this a hierarchy of seven angels? They talk about the Milky Way. They have words for it. And the galaxy is known to the Finno-Ugrians, and they call it the way of the birds. The man watching over the world was associated with the galaxy in ancient accounts. He was represented as a bird, a gander, and an idol sometimes would be built in the form of a gander. Since the Milky Way proceeds from north towards the south, then ducks and geese and swans and so forth that return year by year were involved in this ancient symbolism. In the pantheon of Uralic gods, there is the supreme deity who shows a peculiar combination in the ideas of sky and air. Even the name of this god used to be expressed mainly with one of these two words. Further characteristics were that he lived high above, he was tall, bright, and golden-haired. The trinity of the Vogel gods can be distinguished because they have a father in heaven. He's the creator of the universe. He's positive. He's man. Then they have Joli Turum. She is the lower earth mother. She's female and positive. Then they have the lord of the neither world. He's negative, contriver, creator of all kinds of earthly evil, disease, disaster, pain, worms, death. But in cooperation with the father of heaven, he's involved in the earth activity. It is he that brings up the earth from the depths of the water. The female counterpart, or the wife, is the earth mother, and the offsprings of the earth mother and the heaven father is called the man who watches over the world, and he's the brother of this evil one. So the evil one was likewise the son of this ancient god couple. He carries out his world-watching task. He is the one who ensures happiness in life and health for men, the golden prince. He gives the bright light to the earth, which he walks around every day in his golden attire. So the sun becomes his symbol, spreading happiness to all, the dearest son of the Heavenly Father. What do we have then in these particular early formulations of this renascent Son of God, which is the more interesting because of the peculiar features connected with his birth, which enable us to determine the proper place of this motive? Moreover, the figure of the world surveyor man is known also to the neighboring Siberian peoples. They have a numerical formula using the number 7. That's very interesting. Their everyday beliefs play a determining role in the behavior of individuals. They're governed by the weekdays and even more the feast days. Where did they learn some of the things that they have? They do not seem to have a mosaic calendar of any kind. In olden times, the Finno-Ugrians celebrated the feast days by visiting the so-called sacred places where offerings were made. There was a clearing on the top of a hillock, and there stood a trunk of a tree stripped of its branches. There was a sacred grove. Every large family had such a place. There was blood sacrifices. The ceremony was conducted by a priest, a man of high esteem. He was assisted by some other person in his sacrificial duties. Healing was among his ordinary tasks. They erected idols in the depths of the vast Siberian forest far away from settlements, and as these characteristic sacred places to which later Vogels went, clad in fine clothes, they would place their representative idols in special rooms, surround them with food offerings, not unlike some other primitive people. It was necessary to determine the color of a horse, for example, because only certain kinds were to be sacrificed. They had to be white. The God of heaven required white horses for sacrifice. that was one of the more available animals. When they got further north, it was reindeers. These beliefs have a rather interesting parallel to fire. There are decided overlaps with the Iranian idea of fire. In fact, since the Iranian peoples were renowned for their profound reverence for fire, and the Finno-Ugrians were repeatedly exposed to strong Iranian influences in the course of their history, we find some Zoroastrian parallels. But as we pointed out in another tape on the Iranian Pahlavic texts, some of the ancient Zoroastrian material went back to a early period around 2200 BC of the ancient Akkadians. The words for old man wind god and wind sun and wind woman and the rainbow. The rainbow was the bow of the highest god and lightning was his arrow. This prominent place of the rainbow, is this perhaps a Noachian overlap? Immortality is known only, however, in their ancient epics. Eternal youth and life beyond death are admirable reactions of the human mind to death, this most appalling and fearful puzzle of human existence. They had words for immortality, expectation of life beyond death, and that this life would be lived in the capacity of an eternal youth. The invisible soul, because they believe that the body is occupied by an invisible soul, leaves the body at death. The soul was given three names. The soul never leaves the body until it dies, and it departs through the mouth at the very last moment. We recall the documents found among Joseph Smith's papyrus material about the Sensen document, the breathing document. The soul called Khan has no permanent place of residence in the human body. It occupies the body. The third name for the soul may leave the body while the man is alive, but it'll return. The madmen sometimes visit the world beyond death and return after a short stay there, in which case he'll be restored to life. These are interesting concepts. The conception of the dual soul was known throughout northern Eurasia. Now, scholars consider this type of belief as a very ancient one, and again, it has parallels to the early Jaredite and the pre-Abrahamic type situations. Now the devil and other spirits occupy the lower world. They had in their vocabulary the neither world, the Dachenfahrt. And as been shown before, it is situated beyond the waters, under the earth. It's in a cold country, and that's interesting. Whereas we, in our particular tradition and everything, think of it as being a hot country. But probably neither are true, except that in the doctrine that the adversary will be cast into outer darkness, that would be cold. So they may have a more correct idea about the nature of hell than anyone in the Christian world might have. They did not have a fully developed idea of predestination, but that a person's destiny was made apparent at the moment of his birth, and life had the motive of a journey. Divination, or being able to divine, was one of the most remarkable activities. They had prophets and seers. The ancient Lapps had the Seder stone. In addition to men's bodies, the shaman also took care of their souls. So the priest was also involved with the soul and the body. One of his duties was to guide the soul of the deceased to the realm of the dead. Now the doctrine of the souls of the yet unborn is rather interesting. And the soul of the shaman or a priest would sometimes visit the realm of the spirits. Now this doctrine of the souls of a pre-existence and of the spirits not yet occupying a body certainly could never have been derived from anything that was Christian in character. At least the present Christian churches don't believe such, but it is a beautiful doctrine of the Abrahamic and earlier patriarchal period. They believed in the power of magic, of course, that individuals can conjure up power, and that there was a mediator. This also involved the priest's capability of performance and the balancing function in a community. Now, we find, too, that they dealt with the genesis of the world, how cosmos emerged from chaos in their ancient songs, in their ancient legends and sagas. And this, again, the cult of the worship of ancestors is an institution within the clan. Their clan is a unit and included both the living and the dead. At all times, the clan on earth was an extension and manifestation of those who had preceded them and those who were yet to come. The deceased often returned to his former home as an invisible guest. Besides the dead, it was the spirits which made the most important group of supernatural creatures known to the Finns. They can be classified into the following categories. There were spirits of natural elements, spirits of wind and fire, spirits of natural areas, spirits of human abodes, and spirits with special spheres of activity, such as those of hidden treasures or of men. They were all manlike in form. This has some overtones as well. Among the Finno-Ugrian nations, the celestial gods is in most case the god of the weather also. He is the one who is present in rain and storms and lightning. He appears as the maker of the sky, and the firmament was forged by him. He is the god ruling over heaven and dwelling there. A stone or a tree was often chosen as a sacrificial site, and the offerings procured for the spirit or for the deceased were often the first fruits of the new crop. They were taken from bread with new flour or from fresh cornmeal. They had an offering of bread? That's most interesting. Again, we appear to be in an Abrahamic or an earlier period. The so-called cup stones were also found with these areas. It involved a drink of some sort, a liquid. These are some of the oldest of all sacrificial stones, these cup stones. They had a particular cult dealing with a bear. They had the custom of piling up the bones of beasts in one place in order to ensure resurrection, and thus the survival of species in a rite well known even in other Siberian nations. In the opinion of one student, there are features in the funeral rite of the bear which can only be interpreted as signs to show the bear the way back to his original home in heaven, and the bear may actually be a symbol of the individual. God's son, the bear, descends to earth, is killed, and returns to heaven. You can see the overtones there and the allusions to the ascent of Christ and his returning to heaven after being killed. This does offer an interesting analogy, says one student of these things, to the higher civilizations concerning the murder and subsequent ascension of God's Son in the Christian religions and Jewish sources. The funeral of the bear had once actually been a wedding ceremony. For the he-bear, they choose a bride, and for the she-bear, they selected a bridegroom. Rites also regulated strictly how women had to behave. So the sacrifices and wedding ceremonies and sacraments all seem to be woven very tightly together. You'll find this in modern Mormonism. Probably no other religion has it quite that way. So the ancient cosmogenic myths hidden in these ancient peoples, the sun and the moon, and such things, and the claims that the sun and moon will fall down from heaven and will be freed from the power of darkness, has interesting cosmological and prophetic overtones. When cosmos and mankind had already come into existence, there arrived the heroes whose task was to repair the defects of creation. They talk about a creation imp. They talk about a brother who was born of a virgin, and about a supernatural conception. Now, this sounds Christian in character, doesn't it? Born he was in the night. The belief in his return also makes him part of the heroic tradition. He will return here to die. He returns before the end of the world. It could simply be the information that Adam and Noah had previously as well, and need not be Christian as such, because there was foreknowledge in all other sources as well of these things. There's an everlasting fight going on in the world between the devil, between good and evil. This fight began with the creation of the world and living things, and the myth about the creation of the earth, for instance, does show a dualistic conception and construction. Before creating the world, God had been sailing in the cosmos, and then he found a creature who says, who are you? He says, I am Satan, or the devil. He says, then you dive into the deep and bring up some mud. Legends have their roots, it seems, in different strata of pre-Christian mythology. Some of this may actually be Christian in character. These prose legends are not that old. Well, that gives you an idea of the religious content of these ancient Finno-Ugrian peoples and how the use of language helps to reconstruct some of these various ideas and backgrounds. The ancient tribes were disrupted. The remotest group is the northern branch, is represented by, of course, the Lapps, then the Finnish a little further south, and then you have the Russians in the Kama and Volga River area, and the Hungarians, stretching over to the Yenisei River and over to the far northwest area of Norway. These ancient Finno-Ugrian languages and people could very well have been a parallel immigration of, or migration of people similar to the Jaredites, carrying with them a unique philosophy and religious background, uncontaminated for several millennia. And now, of course, as we study these ancient languages and documents, we can come up with some rather fascinating and interesting things. That's further evidence that there is a basis in the scriptures and in the restoration to go and search for your ancestry, because it was a genealogical search that took me to Finland and to Russia and to find out these things. It's a constant source of marvelous background. One document came out of Hungary, just to show you something of rather interesting character. It's an Enochian document. In this document, Enoch plays an important role, positive and negative. And in the particular document, a righteous Enoch says, I asked the Lord and said, what shall be in that time? And he said to me, from the time when the devil fell from the glory of the Father and lost his own glory. Whoever taught that the devil had glory in the presence of the Father? And he sat upon the clouds and sent his ministers. Whoever taught that the devil sent ministers to whom? It says, even angels flaming with fire unto men from Adam. The devil sent ministers to Adam? Most interesting. And even unto his Enoch, the unrighteous Enoch, his servant. And the devil raised up Enoch upon the firmament and showed him his Godhead. Whoever said the devil had Godhead. Commanded pen and ink to be given him, and he sat down and wrote 67 books. And he commanded that he should take them to earth and deliver them into his sons. And Enoch let his books down upon the earth and delivered them unto his sons, and began to teach them to perform the custom of sacrifice, unrighteous ordinances. And so did he hide the kingdom of heaven from men. Now these are documents found in Hungary today. They become available since about 1863. They have been found to have been part of the legacy of peoples and individuals who went into Hungary probably before Christ or after Christ, carrying ancient books of Enoch. But whether the legacy is ancient or more recent, such as the books of Enoch, we are finding that in all sources we get rather unique confirmation of Mormon doctrine. So it's been exciting. I've taken you on a little excursion. It was rather personal, from Leningrad over to Finland, and in areas that you would hardly think that anything would emerge that would be at all positive or confirm the restoration. And look, you can see it's been rather exciting. This tells me again that the gospel is not totally exhaustible. That if you pursue the things that the prophet Joseph Smith outlined for us, you can be enriched in your life, your adventures can be great, explorations can be tremendously rewarding, and your life can be enriched. What more can you do but be engaged in the great cause of the gospel? I bear you my testimony that the genealogical research will give you beautiful experiences. May you get a testimony of such research and such activities, and get your own experiences. Keep your testimony. In the name of Jesus Christ, amen.